and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the way the press is framing the wrangling over the $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill, focusing on the price tag instead of what the legislation will achieve, while calling it massive and unprecedented when it pales in comparison to FDR's New Deal and LBJ's Great Society. Joining us is Peter Dreyer, Distinguished Professor of Politics at Occidental College, and we will look into how the press is continually implying that Biden has thrown in with the left, when in fact Democratic progressives are being pragmatic, and it would be more accurate to point out that Senators Manchin and Sinema have thrown in with the right. The author of The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame, we'll discuss his article at the American Prospect, the New York Times' misleading headline of the year, Biden hasn't thrown in with the left backed his compromises, the center-right has not. Then we'll speak with Kai Newkirk, a progressive organizer in Tempe, Arizona, who co-founded Democracy Spring and has trained thousands of people across America in movement organizing and nonviolent direct action, and he has just co-founded a new campaign, Either Sinema Votes to End the Filibuster or We Fund a Primary Challenger. We'll discuss the growing opposition to Senator Sinema in her home state of Arizona and whether losing the support of her Democratic base might move her to support Democratic priorities and not tank the party's chances of re-election and the Biden presidency. Then finally, with the Supreme Court's new term having started on Monday, we will examine the attempt by the court's right-wing majority to have it both ways by moving the court to the far right while protesting publicly that they are neutral and not partisan political hacks, as Justice Barrett has tried to suggest. Joining us to assess the court's pending radical and reactionary shift to the right on abortion, guns, national security, and religion is Adam Cohen, who served as a member of the New York Times editorial board and as a senior writer for Time magazine, whose latest book is Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. And before we go to our first guest, while Background Briefing remains a nationally syndicated radio program with a growing national and international audience, we are relying more and more on our online and podcast audience to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Peter Dreyer, Distinguished Professor of Politics and Chair of the Urban and Environmental Policy Department at Occidental College. His books include Place Matters, Metropolitics for the 21st Century, and The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. And he has an article at the American Prospect, the New York Times' misleading headline of the year, Biden hasn't thrown in with the left backed his compromises, the center-right has not. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Dreyer.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there's lots of headlines now about how, you know, the Democrats have to be more realistic, and for the sake of the economy, they got to back down on their $3.5 trillion, and now the latest we're hearing is that they're talking about a compromise between $1.9 trillion and $2.3 trillion. And of course, by talking about the price tag all the time, they should be talking about what these programs will do for the American people. So this whole thing, I don't know whether it's the fault of the White House not to frame things better, or the fact that the press is so determined to, as they were over Afghanistan, to appear to be, you know, neutral and therefore beat up on the Democrats because they feel that that makes them look fair, when in fact the real headline, as you point out, should be, instead of the headline that you were writing about, that Biden has thrown his lot in with the left, the real headline should be, or a more accurate headline would be, that Manchin and Sinema have thrown in with the right.
Yeah, in the guise of being neutral, the media are really screwing this up, and they're basically allowing Sinema and Manchin to define the terms of the debate, which completely plays into the hands of the Republicans and their corporate allies, because it looks like this is another example of big government, excessive government, bloated government, all the phrases that the right uses. And that's what Manchin is arguing. He's saying this bill is too big. This is a left-wing bill. If you listen to Fox News, it's a socialist bill. And therefore, if you support it, you must be a radical or a socialist or an ideologue, and that it's the pragmatists, that's the way the media frames it, the pragmatists like Manchin and Sinema who are trying to bring this down to earth. And that's a completely false narrative. For one thing, the left view, the left position on this was outlined last year by Bernie Sanders, and that was a $6 trillion bill over 10 years for, you know, the social safety net and environmental sustainability, things on education, on child care, and so forth. And Sanders and the Progressive Caucus in the House, led by Pramila Jayapal from Seattle, they basically agreed with Biden to trim it down to $3.5 trillion. But even that's misleading, because that's over 10 years. David K. Johnson, one of my favorite reporters, had a piece today in his on his website called DC Report, where he points out that if you actually do the calculations, $3.5 trillion over 10 years is the equivalent of less than $3 a day for every American, right? That's the way the media should be talking about it. This is not a budget buster. This is a pretty modest bill, not only because it's over 10 years, but because the tax increases on the wealthy and on big business would offset almost all of that cost. And so the real spending of this bill over 10 years is about It's less than $1 trillion. It's about 0.6 or 7 trillion dollars, less than $1 trillion. So this is not a radical left-wing proposal. This is a very common-sense proposal, as I said in my article. In Western Europe, in Canada, in Australia, in New Zealand, this would be considered a centrist proposal. You know, child care for everybody, free community college, free child care, free pre-kindergarten education, and things like that, you know, paid family leave for everybody. These are things that people in, you know, Italy and France and England and Germany and Scandinavia and Australia, they take for granted. And the New York Times is calling this the left perspective, the left agenda. So, you know, it's not just the New York Times either. Every other mainstream paper in the country is playing the same game, which is making it look like these two corporate-dominated Democrats, and there's only two of them really in the Senate that are being intransigent: Sinema from Arizona and Manchin from West Virginia. They're holding this up. And as I say in my article, this isn't because they're trying to be reasonable. This isn't because they're pragmatic. It's because there's things in the Biden bill, like bigger taxes on big business, and requiring the drug companies to negotiate with Medicare to provide lower drug prices, and replacing fossil fuels with clean energy. These are all things that the corporate lobbyists are against, and they've got Sinema and Manchin in their pockets. And so the Democrats are actually, you know, 98% of the Democrats are on the right course here, and it's just these two moderate or corporate Democrats that are keeping everything from happening. And the Times and every other major newspaper is playing into their hands, and it's just outrageous.
And again, I'm speaking with Peter Dreyer, who is a Distinguished Professor of Politics and Chair of the Urban Environmental Policy Department at Occidental College. His books include Place Matters, Metropolitics of the 21st Century, and The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. And he has an article at the American Prospect, the New York Times' misleading headline of the year, Biden hasn't thrown in with the left backed his compromises, the center-right has not. So, in effect, you're arguing, Peter, that it's the progressives in the House and Senate that are being pragmatists. It's not Manchin and Sinema being pragmatic. So is there a way, though, for the White House to sell this better? I mean, there's an interesting article at the New Republic by Nick Hanauer. Biden's plan to tax rich people like me is the best way to grow the economy. Democrats, if you screw this up, lose my phone number because I'm done with you. Now, this guy is a multimillionaire, and he's just sick of listening to this nonsense that you and I are talking about now. And he makes the argument that taxing the rich is the only plan that would increase investment, boost productivity, grow the economy, and create more and better jobs. And if you raise taxes on the rich, almost everything the federal government does with the revenue will pump more money through the economy than what the wealthy are doing with hoarding their money, which they're doing. And, of course, a lot of it goes offshore in these tax havens that we've just learned about from the latest Pandora Papers. So taxing the rich puts money back in the hands of American people through middle-class tax cuts, and corporations will expand production and payrolls to meet the resulting spike in consumer demand. Tax the rich to invest in roads, transit, bridges, healthcare, schools, and a transition to a green economy will create millions of good-paying jobs while building the physical and human infrastructure on which our collective prosperity relies. I think that's an incredibly cogent argument coming from a wealthy person who basically saying, you know, you can't sail two yachts at the same time.
Yeah, Nick Hanauer is one of those traitors to his class that I love. You know, he's a billionaire who sides with working families, and he's been doing this for years. And I agree with what you said. You know, in the Biden bill, 8 out of 10 Americans would get a tax cut. The poor would get a tax cut of over $600 a year, and the middle class would get a tax cut of about $150 to $200, so they'd be paying less. And the billionaires and millionaires and people making over about $500,000 a year, they'd be paying more. Big corporations would be paying more. That's all good. But I also think that, you know, you asked, like, what could Biden do better? I think the way David K. Johnston framed it in his article today, you know, are you willing to spend $3 a day to make America a more humane and livable and prosperous country? And that means, you know, childcare and health care and better education for everybody, not just for the poor, but for everybody. And even that $3 a day is, you know, going to be distributed more for the rich than for the poor or the middle class. I think, you know, I think that would be a great way for Biden to frame it. I disagree with what you read about that Nick Hanauer wrote in one thing. He said the Democrats are screwing this up. The Democrats are not screwing this up. Two Democrats are screwing this up. In the Senate, 48 out of the 50 Democrats are on board. In the House, there's about 5 Democrats, maybe 6 Democrats, who are against the Biden proposal. And they're mostly from swing districts. But, you know, the idea that Sinema and Manchin are doing this because they're trying to be reasonable or pragmatic, that's crazy. You know, among the states that would benefit the most from this bill are Arizona and West Virginia, which have underfunded schools, underfunded health care, a lot of poor people, a lot of working people barely making ends meet. And so they're screwing their own constituents. You know, Sinema is screwing the senior citizens in her state in Arizona who would benefit from lower drug prices. We'd all would benefit from lower drug prices, but particularly those that are on Medicare. And so, you know, it's not I don't blame the Democrats. I blame the corporations that have two of the Democrats in the Senate in their pockets. And there's a lot of effort right now by, you know, liberals and progressives and by Biden behind the scenes, trying to get Manchin and Sinema on board. You know, Manchin says he wants to cut the $3.5 trillion plan over 10 years to a $1.5 trillion plan. And Sinema won't even say what her bottom line is. So that's crazy. And it's not even in the self-interest of their states, where people in Arizona and people in West Virginia would benefit more than people in most states, because there's a lot more poverty in those states than in most states, and they have underfunded health care and underfunded education. And so it's clearly a matter of, can you shame Sinema and Manchin from doing big businesses the Chamber of Commerce is bidding on the Senate floor? And there's a lot of activists around the country in both states that are trying really hard to get to both of them. There was a group of people the other day taking their rowboats out to Manchin's yacht, which he parks in the harbor on the Potomac, where he lives, and try to persuade him. It's not clear how you get to Sinema. She's, you know, kind of elusive. She won't even say what her, you know, what she really wants out of this bill. But, you know, the bottom line is the media need to come up with a way of being more realistic about what's going on, which is that corporate America, and the New York Times actually had an article about this today, that corporate America is spending hundreds of millions of dollars to lobby to kill the Biden bill, because they don't like the higher taxes on big business. The pharmaceutical companies don't like the idea of having to negotiate with Medicare for lower drug prices. The fossil fuel industry doesn't like the shift to clean energy and the move away from oil and dirty energy and so forth. And that's what's really going on. This is about corporations in America trying to get their way with a liberal president and a relatively progressive Congress. And, you know, thank God for Pramila Jayapal and the progressive caucus in the House. They're holding the line. And, you know, the Senate passed the physical infrastructure bill that would, you know, build the roads and the broadband and fix, you know, fix the infrastructure. But they're not going to, you know, the progressives said they're not going to vote on it. Unless they get the other part of the bill, the $3.5 trillion part of the bill over 10 years, which would provide all the other social safety net and some clean energy things. And good for Nancy Pelosi. She agreed with them and held off the vote in the House on the on what's called the hard infrastructure bill until they can go in unison, these two bills. And Sinema and Manchin are the culprits here, and the New York Times and lots of other papers are giving them a free ride.
Well, just in closing, Peter Dreyer, you point out that all these headlines about this massive, unprecedented $3.5 trillion package, etc., the fact of the matter is that it's roughly 1.5% of the country's GDP, and that's a smaller increase than that of FDR's New Deal, which included Social Security and unemployment insurance, and President Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program. So that's the context that should be out there, surely.
Yes, this is not big government. This is not excessive government. This is not bloated government. This is no more than what a reasonably liberal country would do to provide a government that meets the needs of its people. And it's not a budget buster. It's not going to undermine the economy. It's going to improve the economy. It's going to make America more livable, a more humane, a more environmentally sustainable, and a more prosperous country. And this could be the last best chance we have of taking the federal government in a new direction and wean it away from Trumpism. And if, you know, I know that Sinema and Manchin don't like to think of themselves as Trumpists. But the harsh reality is that if they let this this Biden bill die, then they're playing into the hands of the Republicans and corporations and making it easier for someone like Trump or Trump himself to be elected the next time there's a presidential election in 2024, because people are going to say, well, the Democrats had the House, they had the Senate, and they had the presidency, and they didn't produce. But it wasn't the Democrats. It was these two corporate moderates, Manchin and Sinema, who are doing the dirty deed. And they've, you know, there's got to be a, and there is a full scale lobbying effort to get them to be more reasonable. And we'll, you know, I have some faith in President Biden that he can twist their arms, and that the public and the activist groups can embarrass them, and maybe, you know, once all the publicity is out of the way, maybe they'll do the right thing. But if they don't do the right thing, then this is terrible for our country. So we really, really have to scale it up and push them.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Peter Dryan. We're about to go to an activist in Arizona. So
okay. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Dryer, who's a distinguished professor of politics and chair of urban and environmental policy department at the Occidental College. His books include Place Matters, Metropolitics of the 21st Century, and The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. And he has an article at the American Prospect, the New York Times' misleading headline of the year, Biden hasn't thrown in with the left backed his compromises, the center-right has not. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a progressive organizer in Arizona who's organizing a campaign that either Senator Sinema votes to end the filibuster or we will fund a primary challenger.
I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right, here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you. And I'm wondering what it is I should do.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kai Newkirk, a progressive organizer in Tempe, Arizona, who co-founded Democracy Spring and was the architect of the largest American civil disobedience action of this century. He has trained thousands of people across America in movement organizing and nonviolent direct action, and he's just co-founded a new campaign, Either Sinema Votes to End the Filibuster or We Fund a Primary Challenger. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kai Newkirk.
Great to be with you, and thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us, Kai. And Kyrsten Sinema's numbers are dropping in Arizona. She's becoming less popular fairly quickly. 46% of Arizona Democrats approved of Sinema's job performance in the third quarter of 2021, down 21 points from the first quarter, and 42% of all Arizona voters approved of her, compared to 48% who said the same earlier this year. So she's vulnerable. And also, there was an incident at Arizona State University where she was a bunch of students tried to question her. I think they chased her into a bathroom. Do you know anything more about that? She, of course, has come out and made the statement that their behavior was wholly inappropriate. What happened in this confrontation at Arizona State University's bathroom?
Well, I think, you know, what's inappropriate that we need to focus on is that Sinema is betraying the voters who elected her, and especially the people who worked hardest to do that. And the poll numbers that you talked about, I think it's a 41% drop in her net support among Democrats over this year. And that's a testament to two things. One, that she is almost single-handedly standing in the way of so much change that could be transformative for people's lives by protecting the filibuster at the expense of Biden's agenda and Democrats being able to pass anything, and now blocking this Build Back Better Reconciliation Act. And people feel the consequences of that, whether it's people whose family members are counting on a path to citizenship, or who need a raise in the minimum wage, who are concerned that they're not going to grow up on a planet that would be habitable and healthy for their grandchildren, whose freedom to vote is under attack, on down and down the line. And it's a testament also to the fact that people have come together in Arizona, tremendous movement. The Arizona Coalition and the filibuster that I've been helping to build, along with many others this year, has been leading tremendous fight, all kinds of organizing, including nonviolent direct actions in the tradition of Good Trouble and John Lewis. In July, there was 39 of us, including Reverend Jesse Jackson and Reverend William Barber from the Poor People's Campaign, that were arrested nonviolently, peacefully, sitting in outside her office demanding that she respond to this issue. That's very rare that that happens in Arizona. And I think that it has really galvanized the public response to say this is unacceptable and this is her last chance now. She needs to change or we're going to have no choice but to remove her. And that's why we launched the Crowd Pack, to make that attach money to that and show that they're going to be donors in Arizona and across the country, working class, middle class folks that will come together and give the resources to a primary challenger to be competitive and defeat her if necessary, if she refuses to take this last chance to join with the party to stop this extremist obstruction and help us actually deliver the agenda that Democrats, including her, were elected to pass.
So if she fails to do that, the worst has not happened yet, that you could still argue that they're negotiating and there's the typical sort of backroom political maneuvering going on. But if she tanks the Democratic agenda and destroys the Biden presidency, she is going to be so hated across the country by Democrats. Is she aware of that, do you think? I mean, obviously, you're demonstrating outside of her office in Arizona because she won't talk to you, right? I mean, she won't talk to anybody, as far as I know. She won't talk to the press, for example. So have you ever had an interaction with her? Have you ever been able to get to her to find out why she's doing what she's doing?
Personally, I have not, and very few others have had. In our coalition, we had a meeting with representatives of many different organizations on Zoom with some staff months ago, and basically got the same runaround that she thinks, oh, the filibuster is going to help with bipartisan compromise, which is ridiculous. They can't even pass something to raise the debt limit to make sure that we don't default and create a global financial crisis. Republicans won't even help with that. So is the filibuster helping create that compromise right now? Absolutely not. That's an increasingly absurd argument. And you're so right that Sinema is not just taking these extreme positions that are out of step with the voters that elected her, but she's going about the basic business of being in office in an incredibly rare and strange and unacceptable way, where she's so unaccountable and so inaccessible. She very rarely talks to any press. She won't do. She hasn't done, I think, one town hall in 3 years. And she does basically no events that are accessible to constituents, to the voters that elected her. However, if you're a big corporate donor, then she's got time. Then she's going to do a fundraiser. Then she's going to do a call with you. And that is just unacceptable. And I think many people are saying, how can we understand what it is that she's doing? And is she unwell in some way? You know, she's put forward this theory that from her time in the state legislature, she learned that she had to do compromises with Republicans and so on. This is not 2008 anymore. This is not John McCain's Republican Party. This is the Donald Trump Republican Party that backed the January 6th riot at our Capitol to try to overturn an election based on a lie. This is a different world that we're living in. She needs to adjust to being part of the majority in a situation where we have to use our power to govern, to save our democracy, to save our planet, and to make a difference in many different crises that working families are facing in our country.
And again, I'm speaking with Kai Newkirk, who's a progressive organizer in Tempe, Arizona, who co-founded Democracy Spring and was the architect of the largest American civil disobedience action of this century. He has trained thousands of people across America in movement organizing and nonviolent direct action, and he's just co-founded a new campaign, Either Sinema Votes to End the Filibuster or We Fund a Primary Challenger. Well, just to address the issue of that she's not well, there is some rumors to the effect that this person may be a narcissist on the level of Donald Trump, that she's kind of a Marie Antoinette character who is all about attention, and she's getting a lot of attention now. And apparently, I've talked to a number of Senate insiders who worked for many years with the majority leader, for example, Harry Reid. And they're suggesting that you can't reach her. You can reach Joe Manchin. He's rational. You may not agree with him, and he's probably the only Democrat that could get elected in that conservative state. So to some extent, you understand what he's doing, although his family does own a coal company, so he's not exactly not without corruption there. But she is such a mystery, and I don't know whether you read the piece in the last Sunday's New York Times about her by Maureen Dowd. It's a frightening portrait.
I missed that one. There's been so much.
Pardon?
Well, I think one thing I left out is that perhaps the simplest explanation is that she has become increasingly beholden to corporate money and big donors, and has made a political calculation over time that is kind of bought into the systemic corruption that is undermining our democracy across the board. And it's a gross example of that all this money has come in very recently in support of her from Big Pharma, just before and during the time where she comes out and says she's going to oppose perhaps the most popular policy proposal the Democrats are pushing on, campaigned on, and won on, which is to use Medicare to negotiate drug prices with Big Pharma so we can drive those costs down and Americans aren't paying the highest prices in the world and seniors don't have to choose between, making their rent on time and getting the prescription drugs that they need. So that is perhaps the simplest explanation, but I want to be clear. People speculate, oh, she's not going to run again. She's got this cushy corporate lobbyist gig lined up. That's all speculation. What we know is that she's very committed she worked really hard to get elected and to run for other offices and to continue to move up. She's incredibly ambitious in that respect. And all of her statements indicate that she's very focused on winning re-election and pursuing this political strategy that she has. So we have to assume that she's a rational political actor. She wants to be re-elected and she's concerned about power like every other politician. And that's why we have to use every tool right now to move her. Because as you said, the stakes are so high right now. If we're not able to end the filibuster or reform it enough so that the majority can pass legislation, if we're not able to get this reconciliation bill done, then the stakes for our climate, for our democracy are tremendous. If we can't show the Democrats that government, period, can actually deliver for working people and stave off the extreme threat of an authoritarian nationalist right-wing movement that has taken over the Republican Party. So we have to get this done. And that's why we're asking people to use every tool. And a lot of people love to tweet in anger at Sinema. And I appreciate that. I can resonate with that. But you can do more than that right now, even if you're not in Arizona. You can go, if you go to my Twitter, @Kai_Newkirk, you'll see the pinned tweet there. Take you to our CrowdPack page, and you can pledge a donation that if she doesn't change course, we'll fund a primary challenge. Because we want to be able to show her in the most concrete way possible the political stakes for her. If the existential stakes for our democracy, for our planet, for so many working families don't move her, let's show her that the political stakes of her current course of action are existential as well. And that if she wants to preserve her political future, she has to get on board filibuster and help us deliver on Biden's agenda. We've got to stay focused on what we can do.
Well, but there's a contradiction here between the fact that she's cozying up to lobbyists, and the most egregious one, of course, was taking $750,000 from Big Pharma to stop Medicare's ability to bargain down prescription drugs, which, is, as you point out, is one of the most popular items of the Democratic agenda. And if they fail to come through on that, I think they're not going to hold the House and Senate in 2022 and lose the presidency in 2024. And, of course, in the face of massive voter suppression already, it's an uphill climb for the Democrats. So the fact that she's tanking in the polls, that her Democratic base is turning against her, and if she continues on the path she's on and even goes as far to scuttle the Biden agenda and the Democrats' agenda and render them impotent in the face of 2022, is she... The reason I brought up questions about her being sort of a just drunk with attention and capricious and sort of Marie Antoinette-like, because we all remember the little curtsy she did when she voted down the $15 an hour minimum wage, is that she could possibly walk across the aisle. She spends a lot of time in the Senate literally sitting on the Republican side of the aisle. Is that a possibility, that she could basically hand over the Senate to Mitch McConnell?
I don't think so. I mean, she's been doing this whole build relationships and friendships with Republicans to try to, you know, get them on board for certain legislation, going back to her time in the state legislature. So that's been a part of her MO. The thing is that she's cast all these different votes to support things that Democrats have been trying to pass for years. Oftentimes she dragged her feet on it. She tried to whittle it down different ways, right? But her voting record, you cannot get elected as a Republican with that kind of voting record. The Arizona Republican Party, remember, right? The leading candidates in the, you know, primary right now for the 2022 Senate are people that are competing to try to prove themselves to be the Trumpiest of Trump followers, right? That are saying, the chair of the Republican State Party says that even after this fraudulent audit that they had, took all this time, wasted all this money searching for bamboo in the ballots, right? Came back and said, actually, they found more votes for Biden. That the state party chair said, oh, we need to do all the other counties besides Maricopa and all the other states, right? This is the level of extreme and delusional right-wing thinking that's happened in the Republican Party. So that those folks, they may appreciate that Sinema is helping to obstruct Biden's agenda right now, but they're not going to vote for her. And she's not an institution like a John McCain or even Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, who've been in office and power there for so long, could go independent. She needs the organizations, the infrastructure, the funding, the voters, the activists of the Democratic Party coalition to be reelected. And that's what's at stake for her right now.
So she couldn't run as an independent in 2024?
No, I don't think that she can run as an independent. I think she's that's a real miscalculation about where Arizona stands and what it takes to get reelected. Again, she's not a established multi-decade political institution with her own brand that can contend in that kind of way. She needs the resources and the voters and the organizations that make up the Democratic Party coalition to be elected. And that's what we're trying to demonstrate to her right now, is that if she doesn't change course, she's going to lose that, and she's going to lose it for good.
Well, just in closing, though, I wonder how you can influence her, because you're obviously trying to get her to stop this ridiculous idea of how sacred the filibuster is. She actually she and her staff wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post recently about why she's defending the filibuster, and it made absolutely no sense. It had no historical coherence to it. And as you pointed out earlier in this interview, the Republicans are willing to tank the entire economy because of their spiteful behavior. And, you know, the idea that the filibuster is creating bipartisanship in the face of Mitch McConnell is such a ludicrous notion. So There's no rational way to deal with this person, from what I can tell, or is there? I mean, there's always been this kind of Age of Enlightenment idea that if you come up with a better argument, you win the argument. Well, that's not been working for some time. So I just in closing, what can be done to reach this person to say what you're doing doesn't make sense, and at least smoke her out on whether she's basically just become a, I was going to use the word whore, but I can't use that, for big money.
Well, I think what we have to understand is that, you know, movements, everyday people, organizers in our country, we often face long odds. And those who came before us overcame much greater obstacles in trying to figure out how to move Kyrsten Sinema. And we're not going to know ultimately where she stands until she has to actually cast a vote. Would she be willing to go to the floor and cast a vote on her own or alongside Joe Manchin that would tank this legislation, that would defeat the reconciliation bill, that would prevent filibuster reform, that's her only path on voting rights, on down the line, right? And we're not going to know until we get to that point, or perhaps get there multiple times. And so we have to continue to make the reasoned argument, but we also have to marshal power, right? And sometimes when you can't have a conversation as equals because of institutional power imbalance, you have to change that to be able to then have that real reasoned argument for them to actually listen and take seriously what you say. And so that's why we've been organizing for months in the state, using all these different tools. And that's why we're going to keep fighting in that way. And that's why we need the support of people around the country and in Arizona who can do more than just speak out or be upset about it in silence, that you can actually make a contribution, put your money where your mouth is, and make a pledge at the crowd pack to say to Sinema, if she doesn't change course, if she doesn't vote to help us end or reform the filibuster this year and pass Biden's agenda on reconciliation, that will fund a primary challenger to replace her with someone who will. So again, I encourage people that you can be part of the solution, you can be part of the fight, to find a way and get a breakthrough here, which we need to because the stakes are so high. So go to my pinned tweet at Kai underscore Newkirk on Twitter. Click on the crowd pack there and make a pledge. Be part of trying to do everything that we can to win this fight, because for our democracy, for our planet, we need to.
Well, Kai Newkirk, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Again, great to be with you. Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Kai Newkirk, who's a progressive organizer in Tempe, Arizona, who co-founded Democracy Spring and was the architect of the largest American civil disobedience action of this century. He has trained thousands of people across America in movement organizing and nonviolent direct action, and he's just co-founded a new campaign, Either Sinema Votes to End the Filibuster or We Fund a Primary Challenger. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Supreme Court's new term that started on Monday and the extent to which there will be a reactionary right-wing shift on abortion, guns, national security, and religion.
I'll give you power over me. I'll give you power. But now I gotta be free. I'll give you power. But now I'm sick. I give you power. I can take it away. I can take it away.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Adam Cohen, who served as a member of the New York Times editorial board and as a senior writer for Time magazine. He's the author of Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck, and Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle, and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. And his latest book is Supreme Inequality, The Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Cohen.
Oh, great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us, Adam. And on Monday, the Supreme Court began its new terms, and it's sort of they're a little petulant, the conservative majority. In fact, the conservative supermajority. The more the court moves to the right, the more these six conservative justices insist that they're neutral arbiters, that or as Amy Coney Barrett said, we're not political hacks. Do you think they're convincing anybody? Because the polls are indicating that the American people are now more and more skeptical of, in fact, they're starting to see the Supreme Court as a bunch of political activists in robes.
Yes, I think that that is a real problem for the court. The latest Gallup poll has approval of the court in the high 30s, and that's a modern low. And yeah, just the sort of things you're saying, people are concerned that this is a very ideological court. They've watched that Trump just made a number of appointments on clearly ideological grounds, and they see it now more as a political actor than as an arbiter of the law. So that's the problem, and that's why we've seen in the last week or two, you know, no less than four justices come out and say publicly, hey, we're not political hacks. And that's because they're responding to, you know, what they see as some very real criticism of the court.
Well, they can't have it both ways, though, can they? Or can they?
Well, that's what we're going to see this term, because, you know, we're getting into an area where they're going to be asked to make potentially some very, very political rulings. And the question is whether they can make those very political rulings without hurting the legitimacy of the court. So, you know, you could see this charm offensive, if you want to call it that, of Justice Breyer, Amy Coney Barrett, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, all saying, hey, we're not political. You could see that as them trying to lay the groundwork potentially for what could be a lot of very political decisions. So I think it's possible they are trying to have it both ways, but they're going to be very criticized if they do.
Well, Alito's critique was very snide, I thought. And he talked about the press being paranoid about the shadow docket. Well, it's not the press that made the most cogent critique of the use of the shadow docket. It was the dissent from his fellow Supreme Court member, Justice Sotomayor. I mean, she's the one who talked about the abuse of the shadow docket in relation to this Texas abortion case. So the question would be, how could this supermajority have ruled on the Texas abortion case without recognizing that they're making a law unconstitutional by negligence? Because it's not going to be decided till sometime, what, in the middle of next year or the late spring or summer? So the facts on the matter is that the people in Texas having their constitutional rights abused. That's just clear as day, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it depends if they still have those rights, right? Those rights that we're talking about are based on Roe v. Wade, a 50-year-old case, and it's not clear if Roe v. Wade really is the law of the land right now. Yes, technically they have not formally overturned it, but the fact that they didn't stop that Texas law from taking effect suggests just possibly that there are not five votes on the Supreme Court right now to uphold Roe v. Wade. So maybe we don't have all the abortion rights we think that we do, because we certainly didn't see it in that Texas case. So what they may be doing is a sort of slow unraveling of very important rights. And, you know, it's like the frog in the boiling water who, as it gets hotter and hotter, doesn't know he's being boiled. You know, they didn't just come down one day and overturn Roe v. Wade. First, they've told us, hey, you know, we're going to let this Texas law remain in effect. And that may be the first clue that our rights are not even now what we think they are.
So is Leonard Leo getting what he wants? I mean, he has an enormous amount of power, the head of the Federalists, the guy that's behind all this dark money that helped get Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, and Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court, along with the others, by the way. He's been around for some time. We know that he's an Opus Dei, ultra-conservative Catholic, and he's definitely against abortion. Can you make that simple, see that simple through line between these ultra conservative justices and Leonard Leo? Are they joined at the hip? Is this his agenda?
Yeah, Leonard Leo for sure. But, you know, it's also others, right? This has been a priority of the Republican Party, of the right wing, of, you know, large numbers of Federalist Society people. This has been something they've been working on since, you know, in my book, Supreme Inequality, I talk about how, you know, it was in the late 1960s when Nixon was elected. Nixon first said, we are going to end the war in court, the liberal war in court that's standing up for poor people and middle class people and criminal defendants and religious minorities and racial minorities and women. We're going to end that and replace it with a conservative court. Nixon appointed four justices in 3 years, ended the liberal war in court. And that was when the first lock on the court by conservatives began, late 60s, early 1970s. Since then, the Supreme Court is, the Republican Party and conservatives generally, have been obsessed with holding the court, holding the conservative majority, and making it more and more conservative. They've been upset that, you know, Senator Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy would occasionally vote with the liberals. And now this may be their moment for Leo, but also for all of them, that maybe they really do have the five hardline conservative votes now to do things they've been dreaming of, overturn Roe v. Wade, really end gun control, end affirmative action, things like that. So yes, all of these people may be about to, you know, really break out the champagne bottles for sure.
But when you refer to the liberal judges, justices back in when Nixon decided to skew the court to the right, they really were liberals. I mean, they keep talking about the liberal minority now. I don't think that Breyer is anything near as liberal as William Douglas and Thurgood Marshall.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, people have written about this, how even the Democratic nominees, appointees to the court of recent times are not the kind of liberals that we saw in the old days. So, you know, Breyer is certainly an example of that. And Elena Kagan, who I think in many ways is a great justice, she's just not as liberal as you say, William O. Douglas, as William Brennan, justices like that. So we're getting a court that's really shifted to the right, in part because Republicans have made extreme right-wing appointments like Clarence Thomas. People are at the far end of the spectrum, but also because Democrats have not appointed very liberal justices. So we're seeing a debate really between centrists and very conservative justices.
And again, I'm speaking with Adam Cohen, who has served as a member of the New York Times editorial board and as a senior writer for Time magazine. He's the author of Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and The Sterilization of Carrie Buck, and Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle, and The 100 Days That Created Modern America. And his latest book is Supreme Inequality, The Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. So as we head into a more unjust America, and in these wholly inadequate Senate confirmation hearings, they never talk about, are you or are you not a corporatist? I mean, the most flagrant example of being a corporatist, of course, was Gorsuch. And you can make the case that maybe he was auditioning for the Supreme Court as a corporatist, because in the famous infamous frozen truck driver case, he was the only judge that ruled that the driver whose rig had broken down in the dead of winter should have stayed with the rig and frozen to death rather than go for help. I mean, go figure. But why is it that you've got the social issues, and obviously abortion is important, get all of the focus, but the Supreme Court is not just conservative on social issues, it's also incredibly conservative on economic issues and clearly wholly in support of management over labor.
Yeah, I think that's right. In fact, in my book, In Supreme Inequality, that's what I focus on, is how the court has been a major driving force for inequality in America, for championing the upper classes against working people and poor people. And I think that's exactly right. And we see it in areas like, as you mentioned, employment cases of all kinds, in discrimination cases, making it hard to have class actions to sue corporations. We see it they spent years whittling away at punitive damages against corporations, making it really hard to have large punitive damage awards against corporations, which are so important because they're one of the few ways that, you know, juries and really society can keep corporations from polluting, from abusing, you know, their workers and their customers. And it's exactly right that when you look at the backgrounds of these people, some of the justices, corporatist is the word. And, you know, Chief Justice Roberts, what did he do before joining the court? He was a corporate lawyer who represented large corporations. So that's absolutely their orientation. And as I say in the book, what I argue is that it's not just these individual tragic cases like the truck driver and so many others where people are really being denied justice, but it's a bigger picture thing that when we look at, you know, America in 2021 and how income inequality is so great and wealth inequality is so great, and it's harder and harder for average Americans to just put together a decent life, you know, people don't think that that's the Supreme Court doing it. They point to a lot of other things. They point to, you know, what is, you know, President Bush or Trump done, or what has Congress done, or what has globalization done? But it's striking how much these rulings by the Supreme Court, weakening labor unions, weakening the right to sue over, you know, all kinds of unfair pay practices, these are contributing to why we have such an economically unequal country right now.
So just to touch on Leonard Leo and the Federalists, they have stacked not just the Supreme Court, but also the federal bench, and quite often young right-wing judges. But a lot of them come out, those that have some qualifications, some of them are outrageously unqualified, but some that are reasonably qualified, almost all of them have a background in corporate law, if they have any legal experience at all. And I think Biden is putting somebody on the appeals court, is he not, that actually used to be a federal public defender. So, I mean, it's a modest effort to sort of swing the scales back in the other direction. But ever since Sandra Day O'Connor, you've never had anybody on the court that has had legislative experience. And as far as I can tell, you've never had anybody high up in the judiciary that's actually been a defender of the people as opposed to a defender of the corporations.
I think that's right. And another, you know, important aspect is that we're getting justices who tend to have the same social economic background. You know, in the old days of the liberal Warren Court, the liberal majority on the Warren Court, every single member of them had grown up in poverty or near poverty, had experiences with being economically challenged in their own lives growing up. And that makes a big difference. Now, you know, we have Clarence Thomas, but he's, you know, really turned against that world that was part of his childhood. And we have Sonia Sotomayor, who, you know, is amazing and grew up in a public housing project in New York City. But other than that, we tend to get people who have grown up in vast privilege on the court, and they just don't have the empathy for people who are struggling. They don't, you know what the experience of being poor is like. And, you know, in the old days, you know, Thurgood Marshall, whom you mentioned on the Warren Court, he used to, you know, really castigate his colleagues, more conservative colleagues, and say, you don't understand what it's like to be poor in America. And Thurgood Marshall did, not only because he grew up in somewhat challenging circumstances, but because he represented so many poor people as a lawyer. We don't have, you know, those folks on the court. We have, you know, it's a real country club set, a corporate law set, who just view America in a way that's very different from how a lot of us do.
So just in the last few minutes then, Adam, let's look at some of these cases that are before the court. We talked about the abortion case, which is getting a lot of attention, and understandably so, because it's such an outrageous law that invokes vigilantism. And even though these conservative justices have tried to defend themselves and suggest they're not neutral, it's almost impossible to understand how they could have allowed this law to go into place without having some tacit approval of what they want in the end here, which is to overturn Roe v. Wade. But the gun control bill, of the ability of New York City not to have people, everybody, every citizen, have concealed carry like they do in Texas and other states. This is obviously a push by the kind of extreme gun lobby. I mean, everybody on the streets of New York carrying a gun, my God. Can they get away with it? Can they do this? Can they succeed? And of course, you've got national security issues coming up and religion as well.
Yes. And the gun one that you mentioned is just absolutely critical. It's hard to think of a worst time decision if they end up overturning New York's law. In New York City, in New York State, we're seeing a huge number of shootings, as we are across the country. Shootings are becoming a huge issue everywhere. They were a really pivotal issue in the New York City mayoral race. You know, how much police protection people would have, how much security they would have. The idea that the Supreme Court might step in and say to New York State, which has a 100-year-old law, very carefully regulating who can have a gun, striking that down and saying, no, everyone has to get a gun. It's really, we're not kidding around now. That's going to affect a lot of people's lives. People will lose their lives in New York State if the Supreme Court decides to open the floodgates to, you know, guns for everybody on the streets of New York. That would be terrible. And they do seem to be on an ideological, you know, crusade to get rid of gun control laws. I mean, that's something that is so out of touch with the way most Americans see the issue, and so out of touch with our times, when people are so concerned about all these school shootings and everything else. That would be, I think, a real tragedy, but I think they may be on their way to doing it.
Well, you know, the Heller decision under Scalia, of course, was an outrageous decision where they literally reversed the predicate of well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It's pretty clear that the first part of the Second Amendment sets the predicate, and the last bit about the right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed. Scalia turned that around, and I don't understand how he could have gotten away with it. At the time, was there a failure on the part of people to recognize the consequences here? I don't understand why Amy Coney Barrett would be happy to walk down the streets of New York knowing that everybody's carrying a gun and a lot of them are people that shouldn't have guns. I just don't get it.
Well, part of it is that they don't walk down the streets of New York so much. They have very different lives. A lot of them live in safe suburban areas. They actually do not apply the gun rules to the Supreme Court. You don't hear them saying, we're going to take away the gun, the metal detectors at the doors of the Supreme Court. They do not say that. They check you for guns there. So they're actually looking out for their own safety with respect to guns quite nicely. Yes, it's an ideological crusade, and that, you know, a lot of them are not people that are in the thick of it, like people in, you know, the high crime neighborhoods in Brooklyn and Queens who are going to be affected if suddenly people are allowed to, you know, carry guns because this law is overturned. So I think, yeah, it's ideology over the lives of real people. And, you know, you mentioned the Heller decision in 2008 was terrible, but what that was about was guns in the home. And this next case could take it to guns in the street, which is so much more dangerous because, you know, I think that the state should be able to regulate whether you have a gun in your home, but I really think the state should be able to regulate whether you're carrying a gun walking towards me on the street. And right now, you know, New York has been doing that for the last 100 or so years. And the Supreme Court seems ready to take that protection away from, you know, me and my fellow New Yorkers. I think it's a terrible thing.
Well, Adam Cohen, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Adam Cohen, who served as a member of the New York Times editorial board and as a senior writer for Time magazine. He's the author of Imbeciles, the Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck, and Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle, and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. And his latest book is Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.